This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Unabridged Recording of Chains by Laurie Holtz Anderson, performed by Madison Lee. Abigail Adams once described her husband John as him whom my heart esteems above all earthly things. I understand that feeling. That's why this book is dedicated to my beloved husband, Scott. Part 1. Chapter 1. Monday, May 27, 1776. Youth is the seed time of good habits, as well in nations as in individuals. Thomas Paine, Common Sense. The best time to talk to ghosts is just before the sun comes up. That's when they can hear us true, Mama said. That's when ghosts can answer us. The eastern sky was peach-colored, but a handful of lazy stars still blinked in the west. It was almost time. "May I run ahead, sir?" I asked. Pastor Weeks sat at the front of his squeaky wagon with old Ben next to him, the mule's reins loose in his hands. The pine coffin that held Miss Mary Finch, wearing her best dress with her hair washed clean and combed, bounced in the back when the wagon wheels hit a rut. My sister Ruth sat next to the coffin. Ruth was too big to carry. Plus, the pastor knew about her peculiar manner of being, so it was the wagon for her and the road for me. Old Ben looked to the east and gave me a little nod. He knew a few things about ghosts, too. Pastor Weeks turned around to talk to Mr. Robert Finch, who rode his horse a few lengths behind the wagon. "The child wants to run ahead," Pastor explained to him. "She has kin buried there. Do you give leave for a quick visit?" Mr. Robert's mouth tightened like a rope pulled taut. He had showed up a few weeks earlier to visit Miss Mary Finch, his aunt and only living relation. He looked around her tidy farm, listened to her ragged, wet cough, and moved in. Miss Mary wasn't even cold in her deathbed when he helped himself to the coins in her strongbox. He hurried along burying her, too, most improper. He didn't care that the neighbors would want to come around with cakes and platters of cold meat and drink ale to the rememory of Miss Mary Finch of 2 Rhode Island. He had to get on with things, he said. I stole a look backward. Mr. Robert Finch was filled up with trouble from his dirty boots to the brim of his scraggly hat. "Please, sir," I said.
"Go then," he said. "But don't tarry. I've much business today."
I ran as fast as I could. I hurried past the stone fence that surrounded the white graveyard to the split rail fence that marked our ground and stopped outside the gate to pick up a handful of chilly violets wet with dew. The morning mist twisted and hung low over the field. No ghosts yet, just ash trees and maples lined up in a mournful row. I entered. Mama was buried in the back, her feet to the east, her head to the west. Someday, I would pay the stone carver for a papa marker with her name on it. Dinah, wife of Cuffy, mother of Isabel and Ruth. For now, there was a wooden cross and a gray rock the size of a dinner plate lying flat on the ground in front of it. We had buried her the year before, when the first roses bloomed. "Smallpox is tricky," Miss Mary Finch said to me when Mama died. "There's no telling who it'll take." The pox had left Ruth and me with scars like tiny stars scattered on our skin. It took Mama home to our maker. I looked back at the road. Old Ben had slowed the mules to give me time. I knelt down and set the violets on the grave. "It's here, Mama," I whispered. "The day you promised. But I need your help. Can you please cross back over for just a little bit?" I stared without blinking at the mist, looking for the curve of her back or the silhouette of her head wrapped in a pretty kerchief. A small flock of robins swooped out of the maple trees. "I don't have much time," I told the grass-covered grave. "Where do you want us to go? What should we do?" The mist whirled between the tall grass and the low-hanging branches. 2 black butterflies danced through a cloud of bugs and disappeared. Chickadees and barn swallows called overhead.
"Whoa!"
Old Ben stopped the wagon next to the open hole near the iron fence, then climbed down and walked to where Nehemiah the gravedigger was waiting. The two men reached for the coffin.
"Please, Mama," I whispered urgently. "I need your help."
I squinted into the ash grove where the mist was heaviest. No ghosts.
Nothing.
I'd been making like this for near a year. No matter what I said or where the sun and the moon and the stars hung, Mama never answered. Maybe she was angry because I'd buried her wrong. I'd heard stories of old country burials with singers and dancers, but I wasn't sure what to do. So we just dug a hole and said a passel of prayers. Maybe Mama's ghost was lost and wondering because I didn't send her home the right way. The men set Miss Mary's coffin on the ground. Mr. Robert got off his horse and said something I couldn't hear. Ruth stayed in the wagon, her bare feet curled up under her skirt and her thumb in her mouth. I reached in the pocket under my apron and took out the oat cake. It was in two pieces, with honey smeared between them. The smell made my stomach rumble, but I didn't dare nibble. I picked up the flat rock in front of the cross and set the offering in the hollow under it. Then I put the rock back and sat still, my eyes closed tight to keep the tears inside my head where they belonged. I could smell the honey that had dripped on my hands, the damp ground under me, and the salt of the ocean. I could hear cows mooing in a far pasture and bees buzzing in a nearby clover patch. If she would just say my name just once.
"Girl," Mr. Robert shouted. "You there, girl."
I sniffed, opened my eyes, and wiped my face on my sleeve. The sun had popped up in the east like a cork and was burning through the morning mist. The ghosts had all gone to ground. I wouldn't see her today either. He grabbed my arm and pulled me roughly to my feet.
"I told you to move,"
Mr. Robert snarled at me. "Apologies, sir," I said, wincing with pain. He released me with a shove and pointed to the cemetery where they buried white people.
"Go pray for her that owned you, girl."
Chapter 2, Monday, May 27, 1776. I, young in life, by seeming cruel fate, was snatched from Afric's fancied happy seat, that from a father seized his babe beloved. Such my case. And can I then but pray others may never feel tyrannic sway? Phyllis Wheatley, to the Right Honorable William, Earl of Dartmouth.
"Amen," we said together. Pastor Weeks closed his Bible, and the funeral was over. Nehemiah drove his shovel into the mound of dirt and pitched some into the open grave. The earth rattled and bounced on the coffin lid. Old Ben put on his hat and walked toward the mule team. Mr. Robert reached for coins to pay the pastor. Ruth drew a line in the dust with her toe. My belly flipped with worry. I was breathing hard as if I'd run all the way to the village and back. This was the moment we'd been waiting for, the one that Mama promised would come. It was up to me to take care of things, to find a place for us. I had to be bold. I stood up proper, the way I'd been taught. Chin up, eyes down, took Ruth by the hand, and walked over to the men.
"Pardon me, Pastor Weeks, sir," I said.
"May I ask you something?"
He set his hat on his head.
"Certainly, Isabel."
I held Ruth's hand tighter.
"Where do you think we should go?"
"What do you mean, child?"
"I know I'll find work, but I can't figure where to sleep, me and Ruth. I thought you might know a place."
Pastor Weeks frowned.
"I don't understand what you're saying, Isabel. You're to return with Mr. Robert here. You and your sister belong to him now."
I spoke slowly, saying the words I had practiced in my head since Miss Mary Finch took her last breath. The words that would change everything.
"Ruth and me are free, Pastor. Miss Finch freed us in her will. Mama, too, if she had lived. It was done up legal, on paper with wax seals."
Mr. Robert snorted.
"That's enough out of you, girl. Time for us to be on the road to Newport."
"Was there a will?"
Pastor Weeks asked him.
She didn't need one, Mr. Robert replied. I was Aunt Mary's only relative.
I planted my feet firmly in the dirt and fought to keep my voice polite and proper.
I saw the will, sir, after the lawyer wrote it. Miss Mary had me read it out loud on account of her eyes being bad. Slaves don't read, Mr. Robert said. I should beat you for lying, girl.
Pastor Weeks held up his hand.
It's true. Your aunt had some odd notions. She taught the child herself. I disapproved, of course. Only leads to trouble.
I spoke up again.
We're to be freed, sir. The lawyer, Mr. Cornell, he'll tell you. Ruth and me, we're going to get work and a place of our own to sleep. That's enough.
Mr. Robert nailed his eyes at me.
But Mr. Cornell, I started. Shut your mouth, he snapped.
The pastor cleared his throat.
Perhaps we should inquire.
Where is this Cornell?
Mr. Robert demanded.
Newport?
He left for Boston before the blockade, the pastor said. Took his papers with him.
The girl is lying then,
Mr. Robert said.
She knows the lawyer's absent and her cause cannot be proved. The sooner I'm rid of her, the better.
It's the truth, I blurted out. Ruth looked up at me anxiously and gripped my hand tighter.
I said silence,
Mr. Robert yelled.
Isabel, remember your place.
Pastor Weeks fumbled with the latch on his Bible.
You and your sister belong to Mr. Robert now. He'll be a good master to you.
My insides went cold, like I'd swallowed water straight from a deep, dark well. This couldn't be happening. Couldn't you send a message to Boston seeking Mr. Cornell?
The matter is settled.
Mr. Robert pulled on his gloves.
If I might borrow your wagon and a man for the drive to Newport, Pastor, I'd be grateful. These girls should bring a decent price at auction.
You're selling us? The words flew out of my mouth before I could weigh them.
Hush, Isabel, Pastor Weeks cautioned.
The cold inside me snaked down to my feet and up around my neck. I shivered in the warm spring sunshine. Ruth bent down and picked up a shiny pebble. What if we were split up? Who would take care of her? I fought back the tears.
Pastor Weeks, please, sir.
Mr. Robert knocked the dust from his hat.
They should go quick. Your wagon will be back by nightfall.
The minister placed the Bible in his leather satchel and pulled it up over his shoulder. He studied the ground, his hands, Mr. Robert's horse, and the clouds. He did not look at me.
You'll be wanting to bring the shoes and blankets, he finally said. They'll fetch a better price that way.
True enough.
I'll have a word with Ben. Explain matters.
Pastor Weeks walked toward his own slave, keeping a hand on the satchel so it didn't bump against his side. My heart wanted to force my feet to run, but I couldn't feel them, couldn't feel my hands, nor my arms, nor any part of myself. I had froze solid, sticking to the dirt. We were so once before, back when Ruth was a tiny baby, not even baptized yet. They sold all of us from the plantation when old Mr. Malbone run up his debts too high. His bankers wanted their pounds of flesh, our flesh. One by one they dragged us forward, and a man shouted out prices to the crowd of likely buyers, and Baby Ruth cried, and Mama shook like the last leaf on a tree, and Papa, he didn't want them to bust up our family like we were sheep or hogs.
I am a man,
he shouted, and he was Mama's husband and our father. And Baby Ruth, she cried and cried. And I thought Mama would shatter like a bowl when it falls off a table. Papa fought like a lion when they came for him, the strongest lion roaring. It took five of them with hickory clubs. Then Mama fainted, and I caught Baby Ruth just in time. And there was lion's blood on the ground mixed with the dust like the very earth was bleeding. And we left there. We three in Miss Mary Finch's wagon. And everything in the whole world was frozen ice for near 2 years after that. I opened my mouth to roar, but not a sound escaped. I could not even mew like a kitten.
Chapter 3, Monday, May 27th, 1776. Runaway from the subscriber, living at number 110 Water Street, near the new slip. A Negro girl named Pole, about 13 years of age, very black, marked with the smallpox, and had on when she went away a red cloth petticoat and a light blue short gown, homemade. Whoever will take up and secure the said girl so that the owner may get her shall be handsomely rewarded. Newspaper advertisement in the Royal Gazette, New York. The snake took us to Miss Mary's house to collect our blankets and two small shoes, but nothing else. We couldn't take Mama's shells, nor Ruth's baby doll made of flannel bits and calico, nor the wooden bowl Papa made for me. Nothing belonged to us. As I folded the blankets, Mr. Robert went out to the privy. There was no point in grabbing Ruth and running. He had a horse and a gun, and we were known to all. I looked around our small room, searching for a tiny piece of home I could hide in my pocket. What to take? Seeds. On the hearth stood the jar of flower seeds that Mama had collected, seeds she never had a chance to put into the ground. I didn't know what they'd grow into. I didn't know if they'd grow at all. It was a fanciful notion, but I uncorked the jar, snatched a handful, and buried it deep in my pocket just as the privy door creaked open. As the wagon drove us away, Ruth turned to see the little house disappear. I pulled her into my lap and stared straight ahead, afraid that if I looked back, I might break. By midday, we were in Newport, following Mr. Robert up the steps of Sullivan's Tavern. I had never been inside a tavern before. It was a large room, twice as big as Miss Mary's house, with two wide fireplaces, one on each of the far walls. The room was crowded with tables and chairs, and as many people as church on Easter Sunday, except church was never cloudy with tobacco smoke nor the smell of roast beef. Most of the customers were men, and a few had their wives with them. Some seemed like regular country folk, but others wore rich clothes not useful for muck shoveling. They made haste, tucking into their dinners, playing cards, paging newspapers, and arguing loud about the British soldiers and their navy and taxes and a war. Ruth didn't like the noise and covered her ears with her hands. I pulled her toward me and patted her on the back. Ruth was simple-minded and prone to fits, which spooked ignorant folk. Noise could bring them on, as well as a state of nervous excitement. She was in the middle of both. As I patted, her eyes grew wide at the sight of a thick slice of buttered bread perched near the edge of a table. We hadn't eaten all day, and there had been little food the day before, what with Miss Mary dying. I snatched a hand away as she reached for it. "Soon," I whispered. Mr. Robert pointed to a spot in the corner. "Stand there," he ordered. A woman burst through the kitchen door, carrying a tray heavy with food. She was a big woman, twice the size of my mother, with milky skin and freckles. She looked familiar and caused me to search my memory. "We'll have Jenny fatten up the British Navy and make their ship sink to the bottom of the sea," yelled a red-faced man. The big woman, Jenny, laughed as she set a bowl in front of the man. The proprietor called her over to join us. She frowned as she approached, giving Ruth and me a quick once-over while tucking a stray curl under her cap. "These are the girls," Mr. Robert explained. "It don't matter," the proprietor said as he put his hand on Jenny's back. "We don't hold with slaves being auctioned on our front steps. Won't stand for it, in fact." "I thought this was a business establishment," Mr. Robert said. "Are you opposed to earning your percentage?" "You want to listen to my bill, mister," Jenny said. "Advertise in the paper. That's what we do around here." "I don't have time for that. These are fine girls. They'll go quickly. Give me half an hour's time on your front steps, and we both walk away with heavier pockets." Jenny's husband pulled out a rag and wiped his hands on it. "Auctions of people ain't seemly. Why don't you just talk quiet like to folks? Or leave a notice tacked up. That's proper." "I recall an auction not 20 yards from here,"
Mr. Roberts said.
One of Brown's ships brought up a load of rum and slaves from the islands. They must have sold 35-40 people in 2 hours' time.
Rhode Island don't import slaves, not for 2 years now, Jenny said.
All the more reason why folks want to buy what I have to sell. I want this done quickly. I have other business to attend to.
Is that our problem, Bill? Jenny asked her husband.
He says that like it's our problem.
Ease off, Jenny, Bill said. The girls look hungry. Why don't you take them to the kitchen? Jenny looked like she had plenty more to say to Mr. Robert, but she gave Ruth and me a quick glance and said, Follow me. Mr. Robert grabbed my shoulder.
They've already eaten.
No charge, Jenny said evenly. I like feeding children.
Oh,
Mr. Robert released me.
Well then, that's different.
Jenny closed the kitchen door behind her and motioned for Ruth and me to sit at the table in the middle of the room. A cauldron of stew hung above the fire in the hearth, and two fresh pies were cooling by the window. Eat first, she said, then talk. She cut us slices of brown bread and ham and poured us both big mugs of cider. Ruth gulped hers down quick and held out her mug for more. Jenny smiled and refilled it. I made short work of the food, keeping one eye on the door in case Mr. Robert walked in. The back door to the kitchen was wide open to let in the breeze. Should I grab Ruth's hand and try to escape? Jenny read my mind. No sense in running. She shook her head from side to side. He'd find you right away. I scowled at my bread and took another bite.
I'd help you if I could, she said. It'd be the least I could do for Dinah.
I wasn't sure I'd heard her right.
Pardon me, ma'am?
You're Dinah's girl. Knew you when you walked in the door.
You knew my mother?
Jenny stirred the cauldron of stew.
Your mother and your father both. I held you when you were just a day old.
I heard she passed away last year. My condolences. She cut two pieces from the apple pie and gave them to Ruth and me.
I was indentured when I was your age. Old Mr. Malbone had 5 of us from Ireland, along with near 30 slaves. Worked us all just as hard, but after 7 years, I could walk away, thank the Lord.
Dinah was real friendly to me when I first got there. Helped me get used to a new place, and people ordering me around.
I thought I knew you, I said.
She smiled warmly and snatched a piece of apple from the pie plate.
You always were the best rememberer I ever saw. We used to make a game of it. Tell you a line to memorize or a song. Didn't matter how much time passed, you'd have the whole thing in your mouth. Made your parents proud.
A serving girl came through the door and the talk stopped. Once Jenny had loaded up her tray and sent her back out, she sat down next to me.
How did you come to be with that man? She asked.
I thought you were at Miss Finch's place. I quickly explained the dizzy events of the last 2 days.
There's no telling what happened to the lawyer, Jenny said when I was finished. Boston is a terrible confusion. First the King's Army, and now Washington's.
What should I do? I asked. The words came out louder than they should have.
Jenny gently covered my mouth with her hand. Shh, she warned. You've got to use your head.
I grabbed her hand.
Could you take us, please? You knew Mama.
She slowly put her hand from mine, shaking her head.
I'm sorry, Isabel. I dare not.
But... Bill opened the door and poked his head in.
He wants the girls. Best to hurry.
A thin woman stood next to Mr. Robert. Her plum-colored gown was crisp and well-sewn, and expensive lace trailed from the small cap on her head. She was perhaps 45 years, with pale eyebrows and small eyes like apple seeds. A fading yellow bruise circled her right wrist like a bracelet. She looked us over quickly.
Sisters? 2 for the price of 1, Mr. Robert said. Hardest working girls you ever own.
What's wrong with them? The woman asked bluntly.
Why such a cheap price?
Mr. Robert's snake smile widened.
My haste is your good fortune, madam. These girls were the servants of my late aunt whose passing I mourn deeply. I must quickly conclude the matters of her estate.
the recent unrest, you know.
A man joined the woman, his eyes suspicious and flinty. He wore a red silk waistcoat under a snuff-colored coat with silver buttons, a starched linen shirt, and black breeches. The buckles on his boots were as big as my fist.
"And what side do you take in the current situation, sir?" he asked. "Are you for the king, or do you support rebellion?"
Conversation at nearby tables stopped as people listened in.
"I pledge myself to our rightful sovereign, the king, sir," Mr. Roberts said. "Washington and his rabble may have taken Boston, but that's the last thing they'll take."
The stranger gave a little bow and introduced himself.
"Ella Hugh Lockton, at your service, sir. This is my wife, Anne."
Mr. Robert bowed politely in return, ignoring the muttering at the table behind him.
"May I offer you both some sup and drink that we might be better acquainted?"
They all sat, and Jenny swooped over to take their orders. Ruth and I stood with our backs against the wall as Mr. Robert and the Locktons ate and drank. I watched them close. The husband was a head taller and twice the girth of most men. His shoulders rounded forward, and his neck seemed to pain him, for he often reached up to rub it. He said he was a merchant with business in Boston, New York, and Charleston, and complained about how much the Boston uprising cost him. His missus sipped Jenny's chowder, shuddered at the taste, and reached for her mug of small beer. She stole glances at us from time to time. I could not figure what kind of mistress she would be. In truth, I was struggling to think straight. The air in the tavern had grown heavy, and the weight of the day pressed against my head. When the men took out their pipes and lit their tobacco, Ruth sneezed, and the company all turned and considered us.
"Well, then," Lockton said, pushing back from the table to give his belly some room, "the wife is looking for a serving wench."
Mrs. Lockton crooked a finger at us.
"Come here, girls."
I took Ruth by the hand and stepped within reach. Mrs. Lockton studied our hands and arms, looked at our feet, and made us take off our kerchiefs to look in our hair for nits.
"Can you cook?"
she finally asked me.
"Not much, ma'am," I admitted. "Just as well," she said. "I don't need another cook. What do you do?"
I put my arm around Ruth. "We can scrub your house clean, care for cows and pigs, work your garden, and carry just about anything."
"My aunt trained them up herself," Mr. Robert added. "And they come with blankets and shoes."
Lockton sighed. "Why not wait, Anne, and procure another indentured girl in New York?" His wife sat back as Jenny arrived with coffee.
"Indentured servants complain all the time and steal us blind at the first opportunity. I'll never hire another."
Jenny set the tray on the table so hard the cups rattled in their saucers. Lockton reached for a plate of apple pie.
"Are you sure we need to? These are uncertain times, dear."
Mrs. regarded Ruth.
"This one looks simple. Is she addlepated?"
Ruth gave a shy smile. I spoke before Mr. Robert could open his mouth.
"She's a good simple, ma'am. Does what she's told. In truth, she's a harder worker than me. Give her a broom and tell her to sweep, and you'll be able to eat off your floor."
Jenny poured a cup of coffee and set it in front of the missus, spilling a little on the table.
"She's prettier than you," missus said. "And she knows how to hold her tongue."
She turned to her husband.
"The little one might be an amusement in the parlor. The big one could help Becky with the firewood and housekeeping."
Jenny pressed her lips tight together and poured coffee for Lockton and for Mr. Robert. Missus bent close to Ruth's face.
"I do not brook foolishness," she said.
Ruth shook her head from side to side.
"No fooling,"
she said.
The missus cocked her head to one side and stared at me. "And you are to address me as madam. I expect obedience at all times. Insolence will not be tolerated, not one bit. And you will curb your tendency to talk."
"Yes, ma'am, madam,"
I stuttered.
What say you, Anne? Lockton said. We sail with the tide.
I want these girls, husband, Madam said. It is Providence that put them in our path.
How much do you want for them? Lockton asked.
Mr. Robert named his price. Our price. 2 for 1. Us being sold like boats of faded cloth or chipped porridge bowls.
Wait, Jenny announced loudly. I'll take them.
The table froze. A person like Jenny did not speak to folks like the Locktons or Mr. Robert, not in that manner. Lockton stared at her as if she had grown a second head.
I beg your pardon.
Jenny set the kettle on the table, stood straight, and wiped her palms on her skirt.
I want them 2 girls. I need the help. We'll pay cash.
Keep to your kitchen, woman. Madame Lockton's words came out sharp and loud.
Did she change her mind? Will she really take us? Work in the tavern wouldn't be bad, maybe, and Jenny would be kind to Ruth.
I could ask around about Lawyer Cornell's papers. When we found Miss Mary's will, I'd work extra to pay Jenny back for the money we cost her, fair and square. Ruth and me would stay together and we'd stay here, close to Mama.
Please, God, please, God.
Leave us, Lockton said to Jenny, and send your husband over.
Jenny ignored him.
It'll take us a couple of days to get your money together, she said to Mr. Robert. We'll give you free lodging in the meantime.
Mr. Robert's eyes darted between the 2 bidders. Ruth yawned.
I crossed my fingers behind my back. Please, God, please, God, please, God, please.
Madame Lockton flicked crumbs to the floor with her handkerchief.
Dear husband, she said, these girls are a bargain at double the price. With your permission, might we increase our offer 2-fold?
Lockton picked at his teeth.
As long as we can conclude this business quickly.
Madame stared at Jenny.
Can you top the offer?
Jenny wiped her hands on her apron, silent.
Well,
Madame Lockton demanded. Jenny shook her head. I cannot pay more. She bobbed a little curtsy.
My husband will tally your account.
She hurried for the kitchen door. Mr. Robert chuckled and reached for his pie.
Well then, we had a little auction here after all.
Such impudence is disturbing, Lockton said. This is why we need the king's soldiers to return.
He pulled out a small sack and counted out the coins to pay for us.
I thank you, sir, for the meal and the transaction. You may deliver the girls to the Hartshorn, if you please. Come now, Anne.
Madame Lockton stood and the men stood with her.
Good day to you, sir.
Safe voyage, ma'am,
Mr. Robert replied. As the Locktons made their way through the crowded room, Mr. Robert dropped the heavy coins into a worn velvet bag. The thudding sound they made as they fell to the bottom reminded me of clods of dirt raining down on a fresh coffin. Ruth put her arm around my waist and leaned against me.
Chapter 4. Monday, May 27th through Wednesday, May 29th, 1776. What a fine affair it would be if we could flit across the Atlantic, as they say, the angels do, from planet to planet. Letter from John Adams to his wife, Abigail. It took 2 nights and 2 days for the Hartshorn to sail from Newport to the city of New York. Ruth and me were housed below the packet boat's deck with 6 sheep, a pen of hogs, 3 families from Scotland, and 50 casks of dry cod. At the far end of the hold were crates of goods stamped Lockton and Foot, and casks of rum with the same marking. I spent most of the voyage bent double over a puke bucket, bringing up every scrap of food and swallow of brackish water I choked down. Ruth stood on a box looking out of a porthole, counting seagulls and waves in a whisper that could barely be heard over the creaking of the hull. The seas calmed late on the 2nd night, and I was able to walk a bit. Ruth was sound asleep in our hammock, thumb in her mouth. The hatchway to the deck was open and tempting. I climbed up the ladder slowly. The few sailors on watch saw me, but didn't say a word. The fat moon lit the water like a lantern over a looking glass.
A clean, cold breeze blew from the north, pushing the ship so fast across the sea, we seemed to fly. I sat on a crate facing the back end of the ship and hugged my knees to my chest. A mist of salty spray hung in the air. The coastline of Rhode Island had long disappeared into darkness. I could not see where we came from or where we were going. Maybe the ship would spring a leak and sink. Maybe we would be blown off course and land in a country without New York or people who bought and sold children. Maybe the wind would blow us in circles until the end of our days. I wiped the mist from my face. Mama said that ghosts couldn't move over water. That's why kidnapped Africans got trapped in the Americas. When Papa was stolen from Guinea, he said the ancestors howled and raged and sent a thunderstorm to turn the ship back around. But it was too late. The ghost couldn't cross the water to help him, so he had to make his own way in a strange place. Sometimes with an iron collar around his neck. All of Mama's people had been stolen, too, and taken to Jamaica where she was born. Then she got sold to Rhode Island, and the ghost of her parents couldn't follow and protect her, neither. They kept moving us over the water, stealing us away from our ghosts and our ancestors, who cried salty rivers in the sand. That's where Mama was now, wailing at the water's edge, while her girls were pulled out of sight under white sails that cracked in the wind. Chapter 5, Wednesday, May 29th, 1776. The inhabitants of New York are in general brisk and lively. It rather hurts the European eye to see so many slaves upon the streets. There are computed between 26 and 30,000 inhabitants. The slaves make at least a fifth part of the number. Letter written by Patrick McRobert, a Scotsman visiting New York. The Hartshorn docked in New York the next morning, just after a sailor brought down some old biscuits for our breakfast. I picked out the worms and tossed them through the porthole, then gave the biscuits to Ruth. Madam Lockton's voice rose above the shouting sailors. "Bring those girls up," she said. A fellow, missing most of his teeth, stuck his head down the hatchway and waved us over to the ladder. We climbed up, shading our eyes against the bright light of day. Men of all types and colors swarmed the deck, carrying casks and chests down the gangplank, scurrying up the rigging to tend to the sails, unloading gear, loading gear, and making me feel very small and in the way. Ruth stood at my side and stared so hard, her thumb fell out of her mouth. The ship was tied up at a long dock, one of many that jutted into the river. The sun sparkled off the water so strong I had to shade my eyes. Tall houses of brick and stone faced us with rows upon rows of windows looking down at the street. They reached higher than the oldest trees back home. There were smaller buildings, too, all crowded shoulder to shoulder, with no room for a feather to pass betwixt them. We had arrived soon after a heavy rain. Soldiers splashed through the glittering puddles, toting wood, emptying wagons, carrying buckets hither and fro, and standing about on corners conversating with each other. Some wore uniforms and carried long muskets. Others, in homespun clothes, dragged fence posts to a barricade. There were ordinary people, too. Maids with baskets over their arms moving into and out of the shops, and cartmen pushing their barrels over the cobblestones, calling out to each other and yelling at the dogs in their way. The working people were dressed muchly as we did out in the country, but there were a few gentry who stuck out of the crowd, like peacocks wandering in the chicken pen. Some of the working folk were black. In truth, I had never seen so many of us in one place, not even at burials. A wagon drawn by two thick-necked horses stopped just beyond the end of the dock. Not far behind it came a beautiful carriage, drawn by two pale gold stallions and driven by a stout man in livery with a three-cornered hat on his head. He clucked to the horses to walk on until he stopped behind the first wagon. The toothless sailor approached us again and pointed down to the dock where the crates and casks stamped Lockton and Foot were being stacked. "That's where you belong. Don't wander off, or one of them soldiers will shoot you dead." He laughed as he walked down the swaying plank. We followed with tiny steps, Ruth's hand in mine. As I stepped onto the solid dock, I stumbled. "There you are," exclaimed Madame Lockton, coming around the stack of crates.
"Be careful with that,"
she said to two deckhands carrying a fine walnut chest.
"That goes on the back of the carriage, not to the warehouse."
The men nodded and carried the chest toward the beautiful carriage with the golden horses at the end of the dock.
"Pretty horses,"
Ruth said. A soldier at the end of the dock picked up his musket and stopped the two men carrying the walnut chest. There was a brief argument. Then the sailors returned, still carrying their burden.
"What is this?"
Madame asked as they set the chest at her feet.
"I told you to put that on the carriage."
"Begging your pardon, ma'am," the sailor said. "But them fellas say all cargo has to be inspected at the wharf before it enters the city. Order of some committee what's in charge here."
"Inspected?"
She lifted her chin.
"Those are my personal belongings. They will not be inspected by anyone. I do not permit it."
Master Lockton had been half following the turn of events while supervising the unloading. As his wife's voice rose, he hurried to join her.
"Now, dear," he said, "I told you there would be some inconveniences. We must be accommodating. Look, there's Charles. He'll straighten this out."
A second wagon had pulled up next to the first. A round, short man rolled off it and bustled up to the Locktons.
"What are you doing here?"
demanded the round man.
"You shouldn't have come back."
"Lower your voice, Charles," Lockton said. "Where are the men I instructed you to bring?"
The round man pulled a handkerchief out of his waistcoat pocket and wiped his face.
"Washington's men took them all to work on the blasted fortifications. Oh, double blast. Look there, Bellingham."
An official-looking man in a somber black coat had stepped out of a building across the street and was striding toward our little group, walking stick in hand. He was followed by a thin fellow carrying a book near as big as Ruth. Behind him walked a slave boy about my height, whose arms were weighted down with a wooden contraption and a small case with a rope handle. The boy wore a floppy red hat, his shirt sleeves rolled up to the elbow, the blue breeches of a sailor, and a pair of dusty boots.
"Bellingham is eager to arrest you," Charles quietly told Master Lockton. "I told you it was still unsafe. You should have waited."
"And?"
Lockton fixed his eyes intently on his wife. "Do not fail me." She gave a little nod.
"You have a plan?"
Charles asked.
"Everything is in order,"
Lockton said.
"Elihu Lockton,"
Bellingham called, waving his walking stick.
"Come join us, friend."
Three more soldiers appeared and lined up a few paces behind him.
"Smile, everyone," Lockton commanded through clenched teeth. "Pretend to be happy rebels."
The Locktons and Charles walked to the land end of the dock. Ruth and me followed a few steps behind, little mice trailing behind dogs that were fixing a fight. The boy in the red hat set down the case and fiddled with the strange wooden thing. It was actually two strange wooden things, a folding desk and a small stool. After he set up both of them, the thin fellow laid the book on the desk, opened it to a blank page, and perched on the rickety stool. The boy opened the case and took out a bottle of ink and a quill, which he set next to the book. He closed and latched the case, then stepped back and put his hands behind his back, eyes ahead like he was a soldier too.
"Good day, Charles,"
Bellingham inclined his head toward Madame.
"Mrs. Lockton."
Ruth started to raise her hand to wave at the man, but I grabbed it and held it down.
"Mr. Bellingham," Madame replied. "How fares your good wife?"
"Happy this summer is nearly here. You know how she hates the cold."
"Please tell Lorna I shall call on her as soon as we are settled," Madame said.
"Very good,"
Bellingham said.
"We thought you were in London, Elihu."
"London?
Never,"
exclaimed Lockton.
"England offers us nothing but taxes, stamps, and bloodshed." "How odd. Word from Boston is that you still lick the king's boots."
Madame drew in her breath sharply but said nothing.
"Why do you insult me, sir?"
Lockton replied.
"We are at war, sir,"
Bellingham said in a voice that all could hear. Several of the dock workers put down their burdens and stood up straight.
"Insults are the least of my concern. I'm more worried about the British invasion."
Lockton shrugged.
"I am a merchant with cargo to sell.
Search my crates, if you wish. Search the entire ship. You won't find the British fleet, I promise you. Those yellow-bellied cowards have sailed for Canada.
Bellingham took two steps and stood a fingertip away from Lockton. He lowered his voice.
I don't have time for your games.
The Committee of Safety suspects you a Tory, in cahoots with Governor Tryon. You've come home to fight us who strive for freedom and liberty. All work on the ship stopped. The air had suddenly grown warm. I glanced sideways. The soldiers guarding the crates had picked up their guns. The clerk at the desk was the only one who seemed unrattled. He opened the ink bottle, dipped his pen, and scratched something across a blank page. I caught the boy behind the clerk sparing a quick look at Ruth and me. His eyes were dark gray, the color of the sea during a storm.
Freedom and liberty has many meanings, Lockton finally said. Am I free to return to my home? Shall I be at liberty from the improper meddling of your committee?
Bellingham held his position a moment longer. Then he took one long step back.
Search the cargo,
he commanded the soldiers, who laid down their weapons and picked up crowbars.
Very well, Lockton said. Am I under arrest?
Not until I find something, said Bellingham.
Then I'm leaving. My wife is exhausted and needs me to accompany her home. Charles will stay and supervise.
The round man sputtered twice but didn't say a word.
Enjoy your homecoming, Bellingham said. It may be short.
The soldiers had started to go through the crates and call out the contents, the clerk writing down the details in his big book. Lockton motioned with his elbow again.
Come, dear,
he said firmly. Madam refused to move.
We cannot leave without my chest.
Now, wife, he said, it will be sent along.
It travels with me,
Madam said crisply.
Mr. Bellingham.
Bellingham, bent over the clerk's inventory book, looked up.
Ma'am,
does your battle for liberty entitle you to search through the private linens of a lady?
The doc fell silent again. It was one thing for a gentleman to threaten another with arrest. The topic of a lady's linens was delicate. Bellingham cleared his throat and stood up straight.
Well, the rules...
Do I gather, sir, from your hesitation that you are unsure of the etiquette involved? Perhaps you lack the proper authority.
She carefully set herself on the walnut chest in question.
Oh, no, Anne, please.
Lockton groaned.
Do not do this, my dear.
Madam ignored him.
I demand that Mr. Bellingham write to his Congress in Philadelphia. If they give permission for common soldiers to rifle through my personal goods, then I will surrender. Until that letter arrives, I shan't move. I shall guard my dignity day and night.
Charles shifted nervously from foot to foot. Lockton pinched the space where his nose met his forehead. The soldiers studied the tips of their boots. Bellingham muttered something impolite, and the boy standing behind the clerk fought hard not to smile. My own lips twitched. A woman defending her underclothes from a battalion of soldiers was comical. I didn't dare laugh, of course, but Ruth did. She giggled, a sound like a small silver bell, a bell tolling disaster. Madame Lockton flew off the chest and pointed her finger at us.
Which one of you made that noise?
Her face flushed with rage, her eyes darting back and forth between us.
I did, ma'am,
I quickly lied. The smile on Ruth's face faded as she figured that something bad was unfolding.
Crack!
Lightning struck from a blue sky. Madam slapped my face so hard it near threw me to the ground. The sound echoed off the stone-faced buildings. Ruth grabbed at my skirts and helped me to stand straight again. She was confused but kept her mouth closed, thank heavens. My cheek burned, but I fought back the hot tears and tried to swallow the lump in my throat. No one had ever slapped my face like that, not once in my whole life. Better me than Ruth, better me than Ruth. Madam sat back on the wooden chest and looked calmly at her husband as if nothing had happened. The soldiers all went about their business, one of them whistling. The only person who looked my way was the boy in the red hat. He kept his features froze in a mask, but he swallowed hard. Lockton shrugged.
You see, Bellingham, I don't have time for your war. I have enough battles in my own household.
Bellingham sighed and waved at the soldier closest to where Madam sat.
You there, carry the lady's belongings to her carriage.
He did not mention me. I was already forgotten, dismissed, though the outline of her palm and finger still burned in my skin. For an instant, I saw myself pushing her off the dock into the water below. But I blinked twice and the vision vanished. I took Ruth by the hand. Madam rose gracefully.
Thank you, Mr. Bellingham.
Lockton offered his arm again to his wife, and this time she took it. Bellingham lifted his hat as they passed. Ruth and me trailed close behind. As we approached the carriage, the driver jumped down and opened the door. Lockton helped his wife as she stepped up and settled on the padded seat. Well done, my dear, he murmured. Well done indeed. Madam blushed. 'Twas all your doing. She smoothed her skirts. Put the little girl up with the driver. What about the older one? She leaned forward to stare at me, standing just behind the master.
Send that one to fetch us some clean water. I doubt Becky has had word of our arrival yet.
Lockton looked puzzled.
How will she know where to find the pump, or how to get home, for that matter?
Charles will find someone to assist her.
I'll take her, sir.
Lockton turned around. The boy had removed his red hat and bowed politely.
I'm Corzin, sir, Mr. Bellingham's boy. My master needs me to fetch new quilts up Vanderwater Street. I could show your girl the way.
The driver and the soldier had finished strapping the walnut chest to the back of the carriage. The driver spoke gently to Ruth and took her by the hand to meet the horses. She giggled and went eagerly. Lockton studied the boy, then looked over to Bellingham, who was inspecting one of the open crates with a nervous Charles by his side.
Excellent idea, said Madam. You know where our house is?
Lockton asked Corzin.
One of the proudest in our city, sir,
the boy answered as he put his hat back on his head. With him standing this close, I could see the gold ring in his right ear, like a pirate's, and a long, thin scar that ran along the left side of his chin.
South side of Wall Street, just past Smith.
Lockton grunted and glared at me.
Be quick about your business, no dawdling, understand?
I curtsied, bewildered at the speed of it all. Yesterday, I had been aboard a ship. The day before that, sold in a tavern. The day before that, I woke up in my own bed and watched an old woman die. My belly ached again, as if I was still at sea and the waves were throwing me off balance.
Well?
Lockton demanded.
Yes, sir,
I whispered.
He looked at his wife. This one might be simple, too.
He climbed into the carriage, closed the door, and rapped at the ceiling with his knuckles.
Go, driver.
The carriage rolled away, Ruth sitting up straight with a big grin, the golden horses tossing their manes, hooves flashing in the sunshine. She waved to me as they drove away. I bent down, dipped my fingers in a puddle, and scrubbed the spot where that woman hit me.
Chapter 6 Wednesday, May 29th, 1776. We are told that the subjection of Americans may tend to the diminution of our own liberties. How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes? English author Samuel Jackson in his political pamphlet, Taxation, No Tyranny.
This way,
the boy said as the carriage turned the corner. He headed away from the waterfront quick, without looking back. I picked up my skirts and ran after him.
Please slow down, I called.
He pushed ahead. I tried to follow. We hurried past the biggest houses I had ever seen, past shops and taverns and manufactories, past city folk walking like their shoes were on fire. But I could not move fast enough, and I was losing sight of him in the crowd.
You best slow down, I called.
Folks about me muttered and frowned. The boy stopped in front of a tavern and waited, his mouth twisted in irritation. I trotted up to him so angry the steam came off the top of my head.
You offered to help, then you abandoned me?
The words spilled out of my mouth.
Where are we going?
And why did she send me to buy water? Don't people here know about digging wells? He waited for a moment, then said,
You ask a lot of questions.
You give dull-witted answers, I shot back.
Country girls are slow-moving, vexing creatures, he said. You're the vexatious one, I said, running off and leaving me like that. We stood glaring at each other, him with his arms crossed over his chest, me trying to catch my breath. Inside the tavern, a woman argued with a man about a leaking cask of beer. On the street corner, an officer yelled orders at four soldiers building a barricade out of logs, large stones, and barrels full of dirt. My heart finally slowed, my brow cooled off, and I wanted to give myself a nasty pinch. Fool! I should have kept my temper. Now he would truly leave, and I would be lost in this horrible place, and there was no telling what Madame Lockton might do to Ruth in my absence. Apologies did not come natural to me, but I had no choice. I am sorry I spoke so rudely. He said. I'm sorry I caused you a fright, Country. Thank you, and my name is Isabel, not Country. Apologies again, Miss Country Isabel, he said with a smile. I should have explained before. We're headed up to what folks call the tea water pump. Rich people get their water from there because it tastes the best. But first, I must deliver a message for my master. Stay here. He ducked inside a stationer's shop briefly and came out carrying a small parcel wrapped in brown paper and two fresh rolls, steaming hot with butter oozing from their middles. Follow this away. We walked the length of an alley to a small courtyard. Someone had planted a garden there, and the first plants had come up. Peas, cabbage, and pennyroyal. Corzin handed me a roll and pointed to a tree stump. Figured you want to set and eat a bite. I have no money, I said. I can't take this. It cost me nothing, he said. The baker's daughter likes the lad who works the press. She brings some extra breads and pies. Go ahead, eat. Half of my roll disappeared in one bite. It was the first decent food I'd had since Jenny's kitchen. Corzin watched me without saying a word. When I licked the butter off my fingers, he gave me his roll. I ate a large breakfast, he said. My pride wanted to turn it down, but my belly was stronger. The second roll vanished as quick as the first. Thank you, I said when I finished. I'm beholden to you for that. Can we go now? I need to get back to my sister. He set his package on the tree stump. The littler one is your sister. That's why you took the blow meant for her, isn't it? A breeze ran through the courtyard, fluttering the leaves of the young pea plants and blowing cool across my cheek where Madame struck me. She needs watching over. He nodded. How long have you been with the Locktons? 3 days. Corzin listened carefully as I told how Madame and her husband bought us. Lockton is a dirty loyalist, he said when I finished. Loyalist or rebel, I don't care. I stood up from the stump and brushed the back of my skirt clean. Can we go? He nodded, picked up his package, and led me out of the alley. You feel beholden to Lockton? Pardon? He's going to feed you and your sister, give you a place to sleep. He can order you sold, beat, or hung if the mood takes him. That could make a person feel a kind of loyalty. I stopped considering this. Someday, I'll find that lawyer and Miss Mary's will, and that'll free us. Until then, we need to eat, work, and stay together. So yes, I guess I'm loyal to Lockton. The words tasted bitter. Being loyal to the one who owned me gave me prickly thoughts, like burrs trapped in my shift, pressing into my skin with every step. We paused at a corner while a soldier drove a cart filled with barrels down the street. After we crossed, Corzin spoke so quiet I had to lean in to catch his words. You might be better served if you placed your loyalty with us. Who is us? My master and those he serves, the rebels, the Congress. We're fighting for freedom from people like Lockton. I'm just fighting for me and Ruth. You can keep your rebellion. How much longer till this pump? He stopped beside a barricade. The brim of his hat cast his face in shadow. You might hear things at the Lockton house. What kinds of things? Useful things. Things that might help you get to that lawyer and your freedom. I frowned. I don't like riddles. Talk plain. New York is a ball tossed between the loyalists and patriots, he said, scratching at the scar on his face. Right now, the patriots hold it. So? Lockton has returned to hurt our cause. Why don't they arrest him? It's not that simple.
plenty of folks hereabouts haven't decided which side they favor. One day they cheer General Washington, the next day they toast the king. Putting Lockton in jail could turn them against us.
He started walking again, nattering on and on about plots and conspiracies and battle plans and secrets. But truth be told, my mind drifted. I cared not a fig for politics nor soldiers. I was worried about my sister, and my cheeks still hurt. Will you help us or not? He stared at me intent as I tried to figure his meaning. It slowly dawned. You want me to be a spy? I asked. Are you funny in the head? Do you know what they would do to me? Shh, he warned. Keep your voice down. You just have to listen and alert me if you hear anything important. You won't be in any danger.
You are a crazy fool. How do you know I won't tell Master Lockton you sought me out?
Wouldn't matter if you did. He knows he's under suspicion. Might do you some good. Bring you favor in his eyes if you told him. But it would be a mistake. Lockton won't reward you. The Patriots can.
Reward?
Colonel Reagan is the officer in charge. He could send you back to Rhode Island, maybe help you find that lawyer and his papers.
I pondered this. Was he lying? Could I trust this strange boy filled with war and secrets? What would Mama do?
I shook my head. It's too dangerous. I'll have enough to do with chores and watching Ruth and keeping out of Madam's way.
All you have to do is listen for talk of the king's troops. See, there you go again, proving you're a fool. They won't say anything in front of me.
You are a small black girl country, he said bitterly. You are a slave, not a person. They'll say things in front of you they won't say in front of the white servants, because you don't count to them.
It happens all the time to me.
There was truth in his words, hard truth,
a hammer striking stone.
If you hear something, come to Bellingham's house in the night, across from where your ship docked this morning. I sleep in the shed room. Tap on the window and I'll awake.
I touched my cheek. I couldn't. I shouldn't.
I can't, I said. I promised Mama I would take care of Ruth. Now can we please go?
Chapter 7, Wednesday, May 29th, 1776. I hired a girl to clean the house. It had a cartload of dirt in it. One of the chambers was used to keep poultry in, and other sea coal, and another salt. You may conceive how it looked. The house is so exceeding damp being shut up that the floors are mildewed, the ceiling falling down, and the paper moldy and falling from the walls. Letter from Abigail Adams to her husband, John. It was near a mile from the tea water pump back down the island to the Lockton house, a long journey carrying heavy buckets that stretched my arms into sore ribbons. I forgot the pain when Corzine stopped, pointed, and said, "There 'tis." The house was made of blocks of cream-colored stone and was wider from side to side than Jenny's tavern. I tilted my head up and counted. Four floors, each with big windows facing the street. There were balcony railings on the roof. There were even windows peeking out at foot level, cellar windows, which meant five stories in one house. A curtain moved. "Make haste," Corzine said. "If you value your life, don't use the front door." The sun caught the ring in his ear and blazed as he tipped his hat to me. I hurried through the side gate. The mansion was twice as long as it was wide. A large plot stretched behind it with a cistern, a privy, a poor excuse for a garden, and at the far end a carriage house and small stable.
"You there!"
I turned around. A tiny woman wearing a green calico skirt, a nut-brown bodice, and a dingy shift stood in the open door to the kitchen. She tossed a pan of dirty water onto the flagstones and pushed a strand of graying hair out of her eyes with the back of her hand.
"What's your business here?"
she demanded.
"I'm Isabel. I'm the..." "Master Lockton brought us from Newport."
The anger drained out of her face.
"You're the new girl, gone for the water. Lord help us, did you get lost?"
"I don't think so, Corzine."
"Funny little boy, ring in his ear?"
She shook her head.
"That's Bellingham's boy. You stay away from him. Bring in that water, we've got a world of work to do."
Her name was Becky Berry.
"Though it'll be mud if I don't pull this house together in a flash," she said as she poured the fresh water into a pot and swung it over the kitchen fire. She barely stopped talking long enough to draw a breath.
8 months. They vanished to Boston for 8 months and then show up with no warning and wanting tea. Tea. I could get tarred and feathered for brewing.